Welcome to episode 103 of Primary Care Update. I'm Kate Rowland, a family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm John Hickner, also a family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. We are recording this today just before Memorial Day weekend, which is traditionally the start of summer for most of us, when people can start wearing white shoes, but primarily is the time when we honor those who died while serving our country. This weekend is going to be completely checkered and colored by the events that happened last night in Uvalde, Texas, and we all have heavy hearts about this.
Thanks, Henry. On this podcast, we highlight Patient-Oriented Evidence That Matters, or POEMS. If you want all of the POEMS, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a POEM a day, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapters and thousands of interactive decision support tools. Check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Updates are those of the commentators, and this podcast does not represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. For a nominal annual fee, you can receive CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians just for listening to this podcast and any others from 2021. Just go to IAFP.com, click on the online IAFP education webpage button, and find our podcast. So this week, we will discuss some British guidelines for the treatment of rosacea, what to do when Dr. Google comes to the office, and vitamin D and COVID. It is my turn to go first, and today I have a British guideline for the treatment of rosacea. Rosacea is obviously a common skin condition, and this was a generally well-constructed guideline based on systematic reviews with a multidisciplinary panel that put it together, although they did exclude primary care physicians from the panel, hopefully not intentionally. So lifestyle recommendations for people with rosacea include reasonable things, such as people with rosacea should avoid known triggers. So avoid alcohol, sun exposure, hot drinks, and spicy foods. If those trigger your rosacea, avoid them.
That sounds from like there, it's right out of Duh.
I almost included that in the script and thought that it didn't need to be said. From there, treatment should be based on the patient's particular phenotype. So there are four phenotypes of rosacea. These are all really easy to say. Erythematotelangiectatic / vascular, papulopustular / inflammatory, ocular, and phimatis. Within those subtypes, patients can have various signs and symptoms, of course, of rosacea. So first-line therapy for papulopustular rosacea consists of a couple of different options. It can either be topical metronidazole, azelaic acid, or ivermectin. The whole reason I included this was just because I wanted to finally talk about ivermectin in a scientific way. Topical minocycline foam is another option. For patients with more severe papular pustular rosacea, oral antibiotics are an option. Oral azithro, clarithro, doxy, erythro, there's a bunch of them. However, minocycline should be avoided. We commonly use that for acne, and acne is a common symptom of papular pustular rosacea, but higher risk of adverse effects for folks with rosacea. Lots of other options for depending on the specific symptoms that the patients have, as well as the degree of severity. For very severe symptoms, we can consider intermittent courses of oral Accutane, isotretinoin. People with ocular rosacea should also consider lifestyle factors and environmental factors. If cosmetics seem to make it worse, avoid them. Dry, smoky air makes it worse, avoid them. Again, local treatments include warm compresses, lid hygiene, eye drops for lubrication. Finally, we can consider a shared favorite between me and Mark. Laser therapy can sometimes be helpful for erythema, and obviously surgical treatment for rhinophyma. So that is what the Brits currently have to say about the treatment of rosacea. Again, very common condition, more common as we get older, but also not uncommon among younger adults. So Henry, what are your thoughts about the British guidelines for rosacea?
Well, I'm going to sit back and just say that the best guidelines in general help us with managing a person with a condition from soup to nuts, ranging from identification and diagnosis all the way to therapy and prognosis. this guideline, because it didn't include primary care clinicians, may have overlooked a couple of those components. So, for example, not only do we have four different categories of acne rosacea, there's probably significant overlap with acne vulgaris and other conditions like seborrhea. So, one of the questions would be, does the guideline help us with being able to distinguish across those various conditions, or do they just assume that dermatologists know how to do this and that in settings where there are no dermatologists, they just don't care? Or so anyway, that would be one of my big questions. And so what are the tools to distinguish this? And so if I were to think about the categories then, so the vascular, that's the one that gives you the redness and flushing and the spider stuff. And generally, we've not had many therapies that have been terribly effective that available to us primary care clinicians. The papulopustular is much more like acne vulgaris in that regard, and that's probably the one that we see the most. The phimatus, that's the rhinophyma, okay? And so to me, that's probably a more challenging condition, the big bulbous nose, and what do we do for those? Which again probably is where the surgical and more invasive interventions. The ocular stuff, between blepharitis and seborrhea and things that I've had a couple of patients with really stubborn ocular manifestations that I thought might have been from seborrhea or from blepharitis, that their eye doctor said, no, this is actually acne rosacea, which just floored me the first time I heard that. So I would really love to see more tools.
John?
Henry, partially to answer your question, it is called acne rosacea, and the treatments are very similar to acne at any rate. So even if we're off a bit on our diagnosis, it looks like we can still be correct on our treatment. But most importantly, it's good to know that ivermectin is good for something.
That's exactly right. And one other thing that I read once about ocular rosacea is that if you have both ocular and cutaneous rosacea, that if you treat the skin symptoms, the ocular symptoms often improve. And I've mentally retained, and obviously you often have to treat the ocular symptoms as you're treating them. But I've retained that as a useful way of treating ocular rosacea too, if you have comorbid cutaneous symptoms. So next up, Henry, you have the quiz.
So our quiz this month is very short and simple. No multiple choice. It's a short answer quiz. What was the very first widely adopted cancer screening test? Stay tuned.
All right. And then, Henry, I think we're staying with you. You are up next.
This next poem is a serious departure from our normal poems in that this is not based on research. The author of this poem, Alan Shaughnessy, is very selective. And so usually if he pulls a commentary, it's for very good reason. And this is one that I thought had some interesting lessons. It's a commentary by Pitt and colleagues from the Journal of General Internal Medicine earlier this year that asks about what strategies can we use to integrate internet information that patients bring to us into shared decision making. So the commentary suggests a four-step process that has a certain level of what you might call face validity, that we should begin by asking patients whether they did an internet search before the visit. And then we should wait to render judgment and then ask questions to clarify the information, determine the source, and find out what the patient thinks about the information. And then maybe subsequent to that, offer an anecdote based on your own experience. And there are some elements of this that is, not only does it have the face validity, but it mirrors the learn model that Berlin and colleagues proposed back in the 1980s to do a culturally sensitive evaluation in that LEARN model, where you start by listening, and especially listening for the patient's explanatory model, that we explain the medical model, and then we acknowledge differences and similarities, recommend the next step, and then negotiate a final plan. So this is an approach that I think many of us incorporate, but to think about how we do this with Dr. Google, or as one of our attendants in Chicago just called it, Dr. Google, I think this is one that probably requires a little bit of study, but it certainly is a provocative approach. Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, we discussed this at one of our recent live meetings, and to me, it is unreasonable for us to expect that people don't go to the internet, and that it's not something that we should be discouraging. But I really like the walk over to sort of this, you know, cultural humility sort of framework, and thinking about how do we really welcome it. Because this is a part of sort of everybody's culture now. And it's also something that doctors do. So if we don't know what something is, Googling it is not far off of how we approach a problem either. And we should stop pretending that we don't just Google things when we don't know what they are about our own bodies and about patient care. So, like I said, I really like the cultural competency or cultural humility approach to thinking about how do we move this forward, and it'll be interesting to see as we do study this framework if it works, if that sort of speaks to patients, and if that's something that physicians and other clinicians start to feel more comfortable with. John,
I have one slight disagreement with the author. I think it's best to assume that every patient who walks in the office has consulted Google already. So I just use that as a baseline assumption. The other comment that I would make is that in our discussion in Chicago, one of the physicians had a very interesting perspective. He said, okay, you've done your search. I've also done my search. And this is what I find, and this is what I think is the truth. And so he says he wants to stand firm, at least in terms of the facts and knowledge. And he said that he will agree to disagree with the patient, but he will not change his position based on what he considers to be a bad search that the patient might have done, should that occur. Of course, in many cases, the opinions that the physician have may well be the same as what the patient has. But I thought that was a very interesting commentary on integrity.
Yeah, and it's all, you know, part of our shared decision-making process, and what the physician is ultimately comfortable with. Great. So I think we take it to you, John.
Yes, I have a double header since baseball season is in full swing. I thought it was reasonable to do this. And although these meta-analyses are both about vitamin D and COVID outcomes, actually, we're going to focus probably more on methodology, because these meta-analyses come to diametrically opposed positions. So first, let me go through them, and then we'll have a heated discussion, hopefully. These were both published in 2021. So that's the first point I want to make. The second point I want to make is that the first one I'll present is all observational studies, okay? The second one includes observational studies, but also two randomized trials. So let's look at the first one that only included observational studies. Now, it's important to note that they did their search between January 1st and December 15th of 2020. So right off the bat, their data is going to be a year old. And obviously, COVID is a fast evolving condition for which there are many publications. At any rate, at that time, they found 21 studies relevant to the relationship between vitamin D and COVID-19 infections and outcomes, with a total of over 200,000 patients in them already. So even at the end of 2020, there were over 200,000 patients enrolled in not trials, but these are mainly cohort studies. And what they found was that individuals with low serum vitamin D levels were 1.64 times more likely to get COVID. So that's a little increase. That's not a huge increase based on cohort studies. They also found that people with serum vitamin D levels below 20 were 2.42 times more likely to have severe COVID infection. So again, an association based on cohort studies. They did not, however, find any effect on mortality, although the odds ratio, interestingly, was 1.64, which would suggest an association, but the confidence intervals were quite wide because there weren't that many deaths, despite that being a very large study. So these authors concluded that vitamin D deficiency may increase the risk, and I would focus on the word may, which also means it may not increase the risk of COVID-19 infection and the likelihood of severe disease. And they were willing to recommend that vitamin D supplementation to prevent COVID-19 is worth it. Well, let's look at the next meta-analysis, which was done a little bit more recently that included studies through June of 2021. So another 6 months worth of data then in this meta-analysis. They were able to find 11 decent cohort studies with over 500,000 patients. 500,000 patients. So like I said, this is well-studied, at least in observational studies. And they found only two randomized trials that they thought were good enough to include. Two randomized trials only, with a total of 330 patients. So not much in the way of randomized trials as of June 2021. What they found was there was not a significant increased risk of COVID infection. Now look at this odds ratio, 1.61. 1.61 is the same odds ratio as the prior study that said there was an association. The difference, the confidence intervals. The confidence interval crossed one. So there was no association or for in-hospital death for vitamin D levels less than 20 with an odds ratio of 2.18. Once again, 2.18 would suggest there is an association, but the confidence level crosses one because it's a fairly small sample size of death despite the many people in these studies. They said the overall quality of evidence for these infection studies with COVID and vitamin D was very low, so low quality evidence. They also mentioned once again that vitamin D supplements don't significantly decrease death rate with an odds ratio of 0.57 or ICU admissions. So, okay, I've said a lot of words. Now that leaves us with two of several meta-analyses. By the way, these are not the only meta-analyses out there. These are just the two biggest ones. And I think next week, our next session, I will in the future present another COVID meta-analysis, which purports to say that there is a positive association. But let's go back to that first one. I'm sorry, the second one that had the two randomized trials in it. So I looked at the data in the randomized trials. And one randomized trial had about 30 patients in the control group and 30 patients in the vitamin D group. So very small. And it did find an association. The larger study that had over 100 patients in each group did not find any association between COVID and vitamin D supplementation. So interesting to see that the larger studies showed no difference. So this is a very messy area, and there is a fascinating website that you can go to and you can see all of the data on COVID. I'm not sure who runs the website, but it's fascinating because it includes over 200 studies of vitamin D supplementation and COVID. And it's the usual HTTPS, et cetera, C19VitaminD.com. That's C19VitaminD.com. Very fascinating to see all of the different studies that have been done. That website has 16 randomized trials listed on it as of today. Most of those trials, in fact, I think all but two, have less than 100 people enrolled in the randomized trial. So even though there are 6,000 patients enrolled total, mostly they're piddly small studies. So the bottom line is that if there's garbage in, you get garbage out. The bottom line is that beauty is in the eye of the beholder many times. Here we have meta-analyses coming to opposite conclusions, which is not uncommon. And the ultimate bottom line is we just don't know yet about vitamin D. We have yet to see a good, large, randomized trial of vitamin D to prevent or treat COVID. All we have is little bits and pieces. Okay, time to pick this apart now. Kate?
I have my list. I'll leave a few for Henry. So where to begin? I'll begin the same place that we always begin with vitamin D studies, which is there's a difference between an association between a low vitamin D level and a negative outcome, and understanding that we can potentially supplement with vitamin D to improve whatever that negative outcome is. So the first question is, does a low vitamin D level, is there an association there between a low vitamin D level and a negative outcome? So in this case, you know, bad COVID outcomes. And then the next step is saying, can we supplement to prevent that bad outcome? And the problem with vitamin D fairly consistently is that we can say low vitamin D levels are associated with lots of bad outcomes. And the step that we fairly consistently cannot show is that supplementing with vitamin D can prevent most of those bad outcomes. And the skeptic in me says probably the ones that we do show are just coincidence, and that vitamin D is probably not as... Okay, that's problem number one. Problem number two is I'm becoming more and more convinced that we should never do binary studies of vitamin D levels, that we should look at continuous levels. We shouldn't use cutoffs because I think we're bad at it. I think that we have not yet really identified the level at which we can say your vitamin D level is pathologically low. We've said, you know, maybe it's less than 30. That seems to clearly be too high. Maybe it's less than 20. That may also be too high to really cause disease in some meaningful way. And so, you know, some of these studies, more and more, we need to sort of look at them on a continuous level and say, okay, really, if we think that this is clinically meaningful, at what point do we start to see that people really have more, more problems because of a quote unquote low vitamin D level? I don't think we really know. Okay, last thing that I'll say is there's a lot of heterogeneity in these studies, and I don't know if they really talked about where that came from at all. I don't know, John, you may have more information because I didn't read either of these original studies, but it seems like it should essentially be the same trial over and over again. And so I don't know what you know about that.
Right. A lot of heterogeneity because they're mostly observational studies, Kate.
Okay. Henry, your turn.
I have a list.
Get in there
too,
with your ice picks.
But my list is different than yours, thankfully, in some ways. So first of all, let's think about COVID. And the timing of these meta-analyses that John alluded to. So there's been lots of rapid reporting during COVID, some of it in attempt to try to inform other clinicians and researchers about what people are observing so that they can actually do additional studies. And so it shouldn't be surprising that we're having many different trials and observational studies in that 6-month time period. We need to talk about study quality, which we didn't hear addressed about the randomized trials. And there are quality metrics for observational studies as well. And certainly that could be a potential source of heterogeneity. We haven't talked about publication bias. So we know that there have been tens of thousands of papers of vitamin D alone. And John already mentioned that there are probably many other meta-analyses of vitamin D and COVID. So if we think about the potential for what we call a type 1 error, this is the potential for just by chance alone finding something that identifies a meaningful association between an exposure and an outcome. Traditionally, that happens 5% of the time. So if you've got 100 studies, just by chance alone, you would expect 5 of them to show some meaningful or potentially meaningful or statistical association. And then the last piece that I think, John, you pointed out that the odds ratios for various outcomes between the two studies were identical, but The question then becomes, how much of that is due to chance alone? And that's what the p-values and the confidence intervals tell us, is that there's just a great deal of noise in all of this. And so if I were to step back with all of the methodologic potential problems, this is when these kinds of studies get out into the public, clinicians, and the lay public, this is just one of many examples that I think confuse everybody, and it renders the potential users to distrust science and maybe look to less rigorous sources of information. And I'm more concerned about how the information gets used as much as I am about the methodologic issues.
Well, thank you both for your commentaries. There are lots of problems here for sure. I guess my bottom line is that there is some suggestive data that vitamin D may, once again, may be of help. And vitamin D is very benign. So I would say to take 2,000 IUs of vitamin D per day, especially for high-risk people, is not going to hurt them. And if in the end it turns out there is a slight protective effect, which we have seen with acute respiratory infections of other kinds, it's probably worth taking. But stay tuned. We will have better data, I'm sure, within the next probably 6 months. Let's move on.
Yes, it goes back to Henry for our tell us the answer to the quiz.
So the quiz asked the question, which screening modality was the very first widely adopted. Okay. The answer is actually a little bit convoluted. So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends that clinicians screen for breast cancer, cervical cancer, colorectal, lung, and prostate. So lung cancer screening was first recommendation just only within the last decade. The PSA for screening for prostate cancer was developed in the 1990s. Now, if we go back a little bit further, breast cancer screening really took off in the 1980s when our First Lady Betty Ford disclosed that she had been diagnosed with breast cancer. Colorectal cancer goes back into the 70s, where the first guaiac-based fecal occult tests were developed, and then colonoscopy became more widely used in the 80s after President Reagan was diagnosed with colorectal cancer. And all of that's really interesting, but it turns out that the first cancer screening test was actually for cervical cancer using the Pap smear, named after Dr. George Papanicolaou, who actually proposed this at a research meeting in Battle Creek, Michigan at the Kellogg Institute. And it might not have gotten much attention because the serial city is not a hub of medical research, and that the meeting was actually sponsored by the Society for Race Betterment. So Dr. Papanicolaou reintroduced his work back in the 1940s, and regional cancer screening programs using pap smears were introduced in the 50s and 60s. And in May 1978, the U.S. Postal Service actually released a commemorative stamp honoring Dr. George Papanicolaou and actually pushes early cancer detection using the Pap test. So there you have it. This has been around a long time.
All right. Well, thank you for that little bit of cancer screening history. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. Here is the URL for obtaining CME credit, iafp.com, and click on the online IAFP education webpage. The Illinois Academy of Family Physicians is accredited by the ACCME to provide CME for physicians. The IAFP designates this podcast for 0.5 AMA Category 1 credits. The IAFP adheres to the conflict of interest policy of the ACCME and the AMA. If you would like, you can read the complete disclosure on the IAFP website. We hope you all enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends, and we will talk to you soon with more primary care updates.